If we can start getting back to our seats here, we'll get into our report. Yes, the vessel baseline restriction evaluation. Dr. Feeney, whenever you are ready.
Okay, good morning, Council. My name is Rachel Feeney. I've been on the joint staff work group regarding vessel baseline restrictions evaluation. I'll be presenting an update on the ongoing evaluation of the restrictions being conducted by the Mid-Atlantic and New England Councils in partnership with NOAA as we're working together on this project. So I'm going to quickly review the purpose, timeline, summary of the current regulations, some of the preliminary data we've pulled together as a group, and then we held a comment period for advisors and talk about next steps. So I'll be summarizing all of that for you. So last summer, both councils identified reconsidering the regulations on these restrictions as a potential response to the executive order on restoring American seafood competitiveness, and prioritize this evaluation this year. These regulations cap the increases in vessel size and horsepower for several of our limited access fisheries. So the purpose of the evaluation is to take a look at the current restrictions and inform whether the councils would like to decide to initiate a joint management action to consider revisions. So we're looking at the challenges in replacing vessels and engines under the current restrictions and considering flexibilities to upgrade or replace vessels, perhaps increasing efficiency and safety without compromising the ability to manage capacity of the overall fleet. So we've been doing this work and starting in 2026. We formed the work group. We held the advisory panel meetings in late May. We're here updating you. The MID received an update last week, as was mentioned this morning. I'll defer to our reps here for the details of that, but it was a lively discussion last week. We're looking to finalize the evaluation over the summer and present the final report at the September and October council meetings for your consideration for priorities for next year. So should both councils decide to have an action next year, we would get into initiating that action and developing that with alternatives. So just for the public's awareness, we do not have an action currently. No alternatives are on the table at this point. So the first regulations for vessel baseline restrictions were on vessel length for the surf clam and an ocean quahog fishery in the late 1970s. These were later rescinded once that fishery became managed with ITQs, and other fisheries had these restrictions come online starting in the mid to late 1990s for vessel size, length, and horsepower when several of our fisheries became limited access. The regs have been revised a few times across the years, they've been rather difficult to administer with different fisheries having different regulations. There have been actions to harmonize those regulations. But the original goals of these regulations was they were one of many effort controls put in place to help constrain catch in the fisheries. This was prior to the advent of managing catch through annual catch limits. It was a way to potentially control the increase in size and fishing capacity and help preserve the size diversity across our fleets. As I said, they've been revised multiple times for improved consistency across the fisheries. Simplifications have been made for the documentation and administration of the program, but we've had continuing comments from the industry that there have been ongoing challenges. Thus the review. So the restrictions apply to most of our commercial limited access fisheries managed by both councils. The list is here on the screen. Currently, a vessel's length must be within 10% of its permit's baseline specifications, and the engine must be within 20% of its baseline horsepower. This baseline is defined as the length and horsepower of the vessel that originally had the permit when these restrictions first went into place for that given fishery. Currently, there's no restrictions on the number of times a vessel can be upgraded so long as it stays within its overall limit. There used to be a restriction on that, but that was lifted at one point. So the year defining a permit's baseline differs by fishery, as you can see on the screen, as these fisheries became limited access over the years at different points. Given the historical differences in these restrictions, it's possible that one vessel can have permits in its permit suite with multiple baseline requirements. In situations like this, the most restrictive baseline applies, and the only way to eliminate that perhaps more restrictive baseline is to sell or permanently relinquish the permit from your permit suite. So we have a number of additional fisheries that are not subject to baselines here, including the recreational permits, the commercial IFQ or ITQ fisheries, the open access permits, and some of our limited access permits. They're on the screen here. So now to get into some data. So after noting which fisheries are subject to vessel baseline restrictions, this slide shows the actual number of permit suites subject to these restrictions in 2025, the most recent year we have of data. So starting at the top, of the 5,700 fishing permits that are issued by GARFO, about 1,800 have baseline restrictions. And of those, 640 are in confirmation of permit history. And then the 1,167 that's in the yellow highlight are those that are issued to vessels. So, and of those, 164 vessels have multiple baselines affiliated with them in their permit suite. So the data on the next few slides include that number highlighted in the blue box, just the 1,167 vessels with baselines in 2025. So this table is a first look at characterizing the extent to which vessels have upgraded relative to their baselines. And the permit types are organized by fisheries, with the rows ordered by the number of vessels in the fishery. For the length and horsepower, vessels are broken down by the percent that are under or at their baseline and the percent that have increased above the baseline. So across the fisheries, the data show that 18 to 33% of vessels have increased in length, and a bit more, 20 to 49% have increased in horsepower. This makes somewhat intuitive sense, as one can imagine it's easier to replace an engine than it is an entire vessel. We heard some of the comments about that earlier today. Some of the advisors at our meetings and public were a bit surprised that these percentages they thought were low based on their lived experience. So they felt like more vessels likely have upgraded over time. This is something that we're going to be looking into more as we go forward with the evaluation to check for any errors or explanations of the data. So the last slide summarized how many vessels have upgraded beyond their baseline. This gets a little more granular, showing how close vessels are to their maximum allowable horsepower. The x-axis shows the current horsepower of vessels in four groups. The y-axis shows the number of vessels in each group. And the bars are color-coded to show how close vessels are to their maximum horsepower, red indicating vessels that are at their maximum allowable horsepower. And as you move towards blue, you get further from that max. So this indicates that most vessels with baselines have engines that are less than 800 horsepower. Many of those are very close to their maximum, the yellow to red colors. This is a similar plot, only length. The x-axis breaks them up into four length groups, and the y, number of vessels. Again, color coding to show the number of vessels that are nearing their maximum length. So for vessels in these length categories, the 31 to 60 foot range is the highest frequency of vessels, and most vessels in that length range are within 5 feet of their maximum allowed. So we heard a little bit about vessel age already today. This figure shows the average age of vessels by fishery for vessels with baselines. And across the fishery, the average age of vessels has increased over time. Back in 95, they were kind of in the 15 to 20 range, and now 30 years later, they've gone up on average by about, not quite 30 years, but 25 to 20 years over time. There was a little bit of a horizontal lull there in the mid-2000s. There could be a few things going on there. There was a vessel buyback program that may have kind of flatlined those numbers a bit. We're looking on to ways to better explain this figure going forward as well. So on to our advisory panel meetings that we had. We know that just looking at these data doesn't tell us the complete picture, and we really need to get the input of people's lived experience. So we held these three joint AP meetings. We had 34 AP members and 23 members of the public attend. We got verbal comments from 22 AP members and 8 members of the public, and we got 5 written comments, and all of those are summarized in the report in your binder, summarizing those meetings. But just briefly, some of the challenges that seemed to be in common across thematically. One was safety at sea issues, reports of it being especially small, acute for smaller vessels with lower horsepower engines. They're having a hard time upgrading to travel or to allow operations in safer conditions. Fisheries are now taking place further offshore. Concerns about lives lost due to vessel conditions. Comments around modifying, replacing vessels and engines. That's a challenging thing for the industry to do. Very costly. We've heard that today as well. Modern engines are very different from when baselines were established. There's been very limited commercial fishery shipbuilding in the United States, regardless of the baseline. So it's very hard to find appropriate vessels that are affordable. Some concerns around the need to relinquish permits in order to replace vessels, and various administrative complications. Length and horsepower are not always documented accurately, and it can be difficult to really know and monitor the specs through the process. Some of the benefits that were noted. There were some benefits regarding the value of permits. Permits with larger baselines have a higher value. There was some concern about removing baselines may devalue some permits, negatively impacting those who have already invested heavily in the permits that they have. And also noting that permits with smaller baselines can be an affordable, more affordable option for people to enter fisheries. There was a concern that without baselines, a few large vessels could quickly catch the full quota in some fisheries. So there was some thought about this being still an appropriate way to constrain effort. Conservation is still has a role, you know, or a benefit to these baselines for some fisheries, and removing them would increase catch rates, triggering accountability measures quicker. Also, no one-size-fits-all sort of solutions here. There was a lot of diversity across the comments, a sense that the horsepower is restrictions are less meaningful for fixed gear compared to mobile gear. There are other measures that are in place, quotas, possession limits that are constraining catch. That they may not be as necessary as they once were, but the details vary by fishery, and the safety issues are less of a concern for the vessels that are already large. Some ideas for modifications. Overall, I would say there were very few commenters who wanted to do away with all baselines, and likewise, there were few who wanted to just keep them as is, take no action. Most people were somewhere in the middle. There was a sense that perhaps the fixed gear fisheries didn't need them as much, so kind of being selective in which fisheries they apply to, wanting some additional flexibility, particularly for smaller vessels, allowing permit splitting, which is a separate issue, but that combined with this idea would add more flexibility. There was one idea about allowing the least versus the most restrictive baseline to apply in your suite, and to exempt hook and line gears from baselines. So after the report today, we will get into finishing up the report. We're planning to add quite a bit more information. We've heard some input from the MID last week to add, and the AP comments. And we'll bring you that final report in the fall. That's it.
Thank you, Dr. Feeney. So what we're looking for today is, you know, just provide Dr. Feeney and the rest of the group some more input on how they want to present this to us in the fall time period. So I'll open it up to questions, but also any comments you want to provide to Dr. Feeney. Mr. Pappalardo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rachel, thanks for the report. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to listen to any of the listening sessions, but I appreciate the summary report. You mentioned the term capacity. I have a frame of reference for how we thought of capacity over the years, but can you describe or point me to the metrics used to define capacity with respect to this report or this work?
So I think that statement was made in a general sense versus where I'm not expecting us to measure the capacity of the fleet we have today. I think a lot more details on an analysis of the details would come with an action if it was prioritized next year. There's just a sense that that one of the purposes of this evaluation is to identify how we could be more flexible without increasing the overall capacity of the fleet, which may have biological impact implications.
Mr. Pappalardo.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So to be determined, should the future council identify it as a priority? I think that's the key question for the council to consider, should it want to take up this issue. Traditionally we would look at capacity in terms of FMP by FMP, and we would assign values to horsepower and length and at one time tonnage and gear type as well. And I guess I would just suggest that there's reasons to do it that way, but I would encourage or hope that a more global view of capacity across all fisheries for the region would be a filter that could be applied to the existing fleet, and consideration of wipe the slate clean and think about the opportunities available to the council through the aggregate quotas that we're likely to have in the future, and think about or envision what I hate this word, but I think everyone knows what it means, a rationalized fleet, if you were to build one, would look like to harvest the range of quotas likely to be available to the region, rather than continue to plot along FMP by FMP. I think that would fit nicely, that work would fit nicely with consideration of some of the changes you're probably going to consider when the IRA projects are delivered to the council.
Thank you for that, Ms. Pappalardo. Any other further comments? Mr. Rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to make the council aware that there's been some, very little, but there has been some informal discussion at the MID on this, because the size and horsepower is a sense of effort control, and it is very nuanced. There's cases that somebody's actually trying their best to stay within their 10 or 20% versus size or horsepower, but there's just not enough options available, or, you know, I'm not going to get into the whole horsepower and engine ratings and all that, but it is kind of difficult. What we were possibly kicking around would be maybe not foregoing the requirements, but utilizing the council committees to help review an application if somebody's looking to, you know, because I had asked the RA how that actually went in the office, and there's only a handful of people that actually review these applications. Excuse me. And if you were to possibly utilize the committees within the councils in the fisheries of concern or fisheries that are being utilized in that permit, they can kind of weigh in and say, well, this is a situation where somebody's trying to upgrade a power plant, they're trying to, you know, get a newer vessel, this, you know, adding an extra 5 feet past what their baseline is in this situation has no implication because of capacity. Same thing with horsepower. I mean, it's not the best answer, but it can be slightly more informative because it's a way to weed out if somebody is actually really trying to cheat the system by taking a very small boat and trying to go from 500 horsepower to 2,000 horsepower, or if they can't find an engine that stays at, you know, keeps them at the 600, but 602 or 618 or something like that. So I think it would shed light on it, and it would be more informative, and it would be, you know, it would take some of the burden off the agency as far as having somebody, you know, having their team have to do all of the investigating. I mean, both committees for both Mid and New England, APs and fisheries committees themselves, are populated with knowledgeable people that usually have pretty good understanding of what's going on within that industry. So they would have a little bit more information and probably be able to weigh in a little heavier. But this is in the very early stages. This was just a conversation we had after the presentation last week, but that's kind of how we're leaning towards it down in the Mid.
Thank you for that, Mr. Rowland. I would also point out that not only committees, but unless you're including APs on that as well, that would probably be appropriate as well to have that consideration. I have Ms. O'Dell, and then I'll come to you, Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dr. Feeney, for the presentation. Was hoping you could just go back to the slide that had the breakdown of the suite of permits. You have a flow chart. Yeah. So is there, you know, depending on how the council moves forward at a later time once this report is done, is there any way to provide a little bit more details with this on, you know, permit suites and what potentially that implies? Is there, when you're getting the data, is this just a summarized data, or could we get it broken down a little bit more for what's involved with you know, what does it look like in terms of a permit suite? Is it, you know, ground fish attached to, you know, how many variations of suites are there? what does that actually mean, so we have an understanding of how some of these fisheries are and permits are connected with one another?
Yeah, we're definitely planning to provide a lot more detailed information about the permit suites. And, you know, there have been some requests for, say, you know, what is the most restrictive permit on the suite, or for suites that have had permits relinquished. You know, was that a kind of vessel baseline issue that seemed to be a cause of that, or, you know, a correlation anyway? So stay tuned.
Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little conflicted with these baseline restrictions, since we have so many other tools in the toolbox. And a fishing vessel is a tool. It doesn't catch the scallops or the fish. It's the captain. And you put a good captain in a poor boat, he's still going to be a good captain. He's still going to land his share of fish. And you put a poor captain in a large vessel, very up-to-date, high-powered vessel, he's still going to be a poor captain. So I'm a little conflicted on what baseline restrictions do. You've got quota-managed fisheries, so the whatever vessel's going to go out there is going to catch his quota. It might take him a little longer if he's not, doesn't have the horsepower to tow the net or something like that. Scallops are partially quota managed with access areas, and the rest is days at sea, but we have effort controls with seven men. So seven men is a big restriction on what production is. So I'm almost wondering why we have baseline restrictions at all, because it's more the manpower and the captain that do the catching, and it's not the vessel. So I think when we debate this, I think we have to keep that in mind, that fishing vessels are a tool, and that's all they are. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Mr. Hansen. Mr. Platt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, you know, to what Eric and John are saying is that length and horsepower are poor proxies for effort and harvest. You know, they're the proxies we started out with a long time ago, but they're very inaccurate and ineffective. Simply put, Rachel, could you go to slide 9, please? So if you look at this actually speaks very clearly to the restrictive nature of these baselines. So you can see that a lot more vessels have swapped out their engine and increased their engine horsepower, and very few have done that with their vessel baseline. And that's a simple economics equation. It costs a heck of a lot more to swap out your vessel, and to go from a 40-foot vessel to a 44-foot vessel, the return on that investment is minimal, negligible. So you don't make it. But the engine needs to be replaced periodically, and so you must knuckle under and do that. Or maybe you value speed. In some fisheries, speed is considered important. In a lot of fisheries, it's more of a marathon. So that's what this chart is saying to me, is that in many of these fisheries, 70 to 80% of the people saw the door as shut on them in terms of being able to expand the size of their boat and have a more profitable, efficient operation. That speaks to a high level of restrictive nature of these regulations. I think, you know, I spoke at the mid about, I compared the U.S. economy and the EU, and the less restricted U.S. economy versus the EU, and over the life of the EU, our economy has grown so much more than the EU because we don't have these onerous restrictions. A more domestic, just to change it up, we all know what's going on in California and Texas. There's a reason why people and businesses are leaving California and going to Texas. It's because of the very, very real cost of regulation. That's what's happening. And people are moving in response to that. But fishermen can't move, and they can't readily change their boats either, as this chart shows. So what I think we need to do is have a pretty extensive conversation with a committee about fishery by fishery, how these regulations impact the management of the fishery and the ability of the fleet to be efficient and therefore profitable. If you're a fixed gear person, these regulations are nothing but a burden. They offer no benefit whatsoever. They're not even relevant anymore. So they're a total loss. So if you're a fixed gear monk fisherman, then these are nothing but an obstacle to you growing your business. And if you want to get a bigger boat and a bigger permit, you have to get another permit to do that, which means the history you have for 10 or 15 years on the permit you currently have, you have to risk that. It starts to go stale as you build it on a new permit, which is why you see the young fishermen have big boats and the older fishermen protected their history and they have smaller boats. The young guys bought permits with no history and took the risk. There's a huge divide between mobile gear and fixed gear, and there's a huge divide within the mobile gear fleet. And I would ask Bobby to explain about horsepower and harvest capacity, what he said at the mid, because it really informed me. I think it was really insightful, and it highlights the distinction between within mobile gear fisheries, and the reason that we need to look at it fishery permit by fishery, not individual permit, but fishery by fishery, as well as gear, you know, mobile gear versus fixed gear. And so I think this is going to be, it's going to need to have, be an extensive and very nuanced and complex conversation, ideally amongst the majority of fishermen from a range of fisheries. And I think this is a very important issue. I fished for 32 years, and I've certainly left well over a million, probably multiple millions of dollars on the table because of these restrictions for me. I'm not bitter about it, and I'm not angry about it, but I knew in the, by the end of the 90s that these things were an economic stranglehold, and it's across the whole fleet, it's not just me. So, and that same thing is happening in other fisheries. So this is really—
Could you wrap up, Ted? Sorry.
I'm winding up right now. Yeah. This is a really important issue, and it really deserves attention, and now.
Thank you for that. Mr. Lucy, with the last comment or question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep it brief. This is a very complicated issue to me. My experience with this style of restriction has to do with longline halibut in Alaska, and they just broke them into boat lengths. And so one thing I just want to highlight is it's very important to maintain those entry-level small boat opportunities for people so they could try it out and get in. I mean, I hear maybe someone can afford to buy a big boat right out of the gate, but that's not my experience. So whatever we do with this, the rationalization comment was really struck a good chord with me. We need to look at it holistically, and we need to create these opportunities for the youngsters that don't have access to a lot of capital.
Thank you for that. I mean, there's a lot of good comments here. Some of these comments, I'm not saying that they weren't useful, but they may be a little more future when we get the final report and how we decide to move forward on it. But I think this conversation has been very helpful. I think, Dr. Feeney, you've got a couple nuggets in there on how to proceed moving forward with the evaluation. Okay. Thank you very much. I will kick it over to Dr. O'Keefe for the second part of the executive order presentation on the herring IFM amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next slide, please. I'm going to move relatively quickly as we're a little behind in the schedule and have one more agenda item before lunch. So just a brief reminder of what the Executive Order 14276 requested. It was that the councils develop work plans to identify regulations, measures that we have that could be constraining and to reduce burdens on domestic fishing and increase production. Next slide. Our approach to respond to the executive order, we asked for input from all of our plan development teams and advisory panel members. we received public comment directly from various stakeholders and industry members, and also received information from NOAA Fisheries, comments that had been submitted directly to NOAA. The executive committee reviewed all of the public comments, and we provided recommendations to the council back last fall. The council considered those recommendations and developed a work plan and submitted our response on September 30th, 2025. NOAA subsequently reopened the public comment period in December after the federal shutdown had ended, and they shared additional public comments that they received at that time with the councils in January. Our council reviewed those additional comments and additional executive committee recommendations, and we confirmed the work plan that we had submitted in September, and we confirmed that in April and submitted a letter in the end of April after the council meeting to that effect. We did not change the work plan, and we did not recommend any changes to the herring IFM program at that time. That was just in April. Next slide. After that, on May 1st, the council received a letter from NOAA, from Mr. Soler, with a request that the council reconsider that decision to not revisit the herring IFM program under the executive order. The rationale provided for that request in the letter included removing unused provisions that are not achieving intended goals, so that's really right from the executive order. Those intended goals that aren't being achieved with the IFM program are accurate estimates of catch, retained and discarded, accurate estimates of incidental species with catch caps. In our case here, it would be haddock in the river herring and shad, and affordable monitoring for the herring fishery. The letter also pointed out that since implementation, insufficient IFM coverage has existed to support any evaluation of the program. Since approval in January 2020, it's never been implemented at the intended coverage target of 50% of the trips. In November of 2022, the program was suspended due to lack of resources for implementation. And the letter in May stated that it's unlikely that NIMS would have the resources necessary to support this program now or moving forward. Additionally, the letter stated that Herring IFM program regulations are the subject of litigation. Attorney McDonald updated us this morning that the lawsuits around Loper Bright and Relentless are in abeyance right now, but the letter indicated that removing the Herring IFM requirements would be an important step to end that litigation. Next slide. The Executive Committee visited this topic at their meeting on June 9th and noted the following. One, that the Herring IFM program is distinct from other council IFM programs, specifically scallops and groundfish, and that other IFM programs are meeting the intended objectives and should not be rescinded. So this is not looking at a blanket rescission of all IFM programs. This really is specific to Herring. They also noted related issues of Herring monitoring coverage levels and cap management measures, and the inability to effectively monitor the Georges Bank haddock or river herring and shad catch caps without the higher level of coverage that was intended in the IFM program. They also noted some related issues of herring monitoring coverage and accountability for slippage events and the inability to monitor vessels' compliance with those move-on rules if slippage occurs. So the executive committee sort of put all of these topics together and discussed options around including an action to rescind the Herring IFM program in 2027 priority discussions, possibly including this in a combined action with our ongoing river herring and shad measures action, and considering potentially adding a few more sort of regulatory burdens, things that we had discussed in our response to Executive Order 14276. We did identify potentially revising or rescinding some of the move-on provisions associated with herring slippage events that we did include in our executive order response. And we will be talking about monitoring of the Georges Bank haddock bycatch caps in our groundfish action. We'll be discussing that this week, that we would like to back away from some of the work that is associated with that. So these things sort of all go together, and what we're looking for is the council to consider how we want to move forward with this. Next slide. So today, looking for feedback, the follow-up that would be required is staff to write a response to NOAA immediately following this meeting to respond to the letter that they sent in May, and for the council to consider inclusion of rescinding the Herring IFM program in our 2027 priority setting discussions. And along with that could be adding it to the action that's ongoing with River Herring and Shad, and considering adding in some of the other measures associated with slippage move-on rules and haddock bycatch cap. And I'm happy to take any questions, and really what I'm looking for is any feedback from council members on specific things we want to include in our response, how you want to proceed, and if you agree that this would be a 2027 priority setting discussion topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. O'Keefe. So I'm sure you've all read the letter. It's a pretty good overview of what we have before us. I look around the table here and I can say that not many of us were actually here when the IFM was put in place. What I'm really looking for today is, I don't normally do this. I've seen past chairs do this. I'm really looking for as much input as possible. I don't want to call on everyone, but it would be helpful if we have as many voices that would like to put in their thoughts on this one. So I'll open up to questions first, or comments if you would prefer. Ms. Ware.
Thanks. I just have a clarifying question in reading some of the correspondence we had on this. Some of the correspondence asked for not only rescission of the Herring IFM application, but also the IFM amendment in whole. And I was curious if we could get a clarification from NOAA on what is their specific request to the council.
Mr. Pentney.
Yeah, I think it's important to clarify that the IFM amendment set up a process for the council's to develop specific IFM programs for fisheries that the council determined were needed one. The only one that we've then further developed and actually developed into a program was for herring. So I think consistent with my interpretation of the letter, is to withdraw the herring-specific regulations. And then, clearly, if in some future council there would be a circumstance where the council determined that the overwhelming need was for some form of industry-funded monitoring program, there would still be a framework for the council to consider developing and adopting that, but there would be no requirement to do so.
Ms. Griffin.
Thank you, Chair. And Executive Director O'Keefe asks whether the council would like to include this as a 2027 priority. And I think even just a couple weeks, months ago, I would have been leaning more towards no, but I think development with herring is leading me towards it makes sense that this could be something that we work with, as indicated in the slide, alongside river herring shad, time area measures, the haddock bycatch caps, and the slippage. When you look at the rationale behind the herring IFM program, very clearly linked to monitoring of bycatch. So if we do move away from catch caps towards the time area closures that are supported by species distribution models, that would make sense to me to consider together, also the slippage. So I think this is also linked to preview maybe a comment for when we talk about herring later today. You know, when we talk about splitting the specs, it's not just about making sure what we don't want, which is, you know, we don't want delays in our measures, but it's what we want in terms of effective management. And by splitting those, I think this is combined with others getting us towards that effective management for herring. So and then I would support this as a kind of combined herring priority with the others when we talk about that later.
To be clear for 2027?
To be clear for 2027.
Thank you for that. Sorry. I might have missed that. Mr. Whalen and then Ms. O'Dell.
Yeah, I'm supportive of what Melanie has said. I mean, herring's in trouble. We've got issues with river herring and shad, you know, in terms of what's going on there in terms of monitoring. I'm supportive of trying to get the lawsuit settled. If this letter from NOAA was part of trying to get that lawsuit settled, you know, relentless in the Roper case, then I'm in support of it. But clearly, I think as we move forward, 2027 priorities, you know, we've got to work toward kind of protecting, you know, the bycatch, what's going on with river herring, shad, and bluebacks. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whalen. Up next, I have Ms. O'Dell and then Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I also support including this as a priority for 2027. I would urge the council, though, to not just think about management measures that could replace monitoring levels, but also look at, you know, the NIMS letter specifically mentions affordability of at-sea monitoring. I would hope that that would also be part of whatever action we look into in the future for herring, is that component of affordability by the fishing industry. So I would really recommend that we focus on affordability, break-even analyses, whatever can be done, since it is going to be, you know, since that's a huge component of this. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Dell. Mr. Smith, and then Mr. Lucy.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. A couple of comments on this. First, I want to express support for considering the IFM amendment as a priority in our 2027 priorities discussion later this year. I'm not prepared today to say I would support it being in the priority discussion to be a priority for next year, but I think it is appropriate for the council to respond back to the agency to indicate that we will take it up during priority setting in December. I think maybe a quick question for the executive director regarding if you have perspective on what type of regulatory action it would be required to rescind the IFM program should we decide to do it. I assume it would be an amendment to an omnibus amendment, but Am I correct on that?
I'm not going to confirm or deny you're correct on that. As I mentioned earlier, we are somewhat in this NEPA evolution and flux, and so we're trying on staff, working closely with the regional office staff, to use the most streamlined, efficient action vehicles we can. So I don't want to say that this would have to be an amendment or it could be a framework. I think we'd want to look at the package of what would be included, if this is a standalone action or if it's combined with the other things that have been mentioned. All of those factors will weigh in. And I guess I would encourage, the way we talk about frameworks and amendments now, I think, is a little different than we have as a council in the past. Amendments don't necessarily have to take longer. Some amendments can be actually pretty quick and less onerous than even a framework. So I just would encourage the council not to get hung up on the types of actions that we use for measures like this.
Yeah, thanks for that. A couple other things quickly, Dan. So I just want to express a concern regarding trying to put all of this stuff into one package next year. Should we decide to take it up as a priority for next year, I would be concerned about slowing down the Shad and River Herring measures that we've been working on in order to accommodate putting in something to address this issue, which is an issue that this council has had multiple opportunities to say, do we want to get rid of it or don't we? And we've said we don't want to get rid of it. I understand the situation has changed, but with respect to the Shad and River Herring management measures, we were supposed to work on that last year. We were supposed to work on it this year. We are working on it. I'm pretty sure, based on the conversation that's going to happen this afternoon, we're going to do a clean spec package in September, and we're going to push Shad and River Herring measures off until sometime next year. I think it's appropriate, but I would not want to risk further slowing down the Shad and River Herring measures in order to accommodate this. So I'll be keeping an eye open for that when we get to that point, maybe early next year, because I think that's a priority. The Shad and River Herring measures are something we prioritized for this year and last year, and I don't want that to be slowed down. And I guess the last point I would make on this is, Dr. O'Keefe mentioned the original goals of the Herring IFM amendment, which was around accurate estimates of catch, accurate estimates of discards, having affordable monitoring. Those are still goals of this council. At least we haven't changed them yet. Those are goals for me. And so I'm not going to be comfortable just saying we're just going to get rid of this monitoring program altogether without having something thoughtful in place to replace it. And that's why I think it's going to take a little longer, perhaps, than trying to do it early next year. I want us to make sure that we can continue to pursue those goals if the IFM program goes away. As far as the lawsuit goes, I don't think it's this council's job to try to take an action to settle a lawsuit. The agency has argued all the way to the Supreme Court that they believe they have statutory authority to require monitoring in these fisheries. And if we decide we don't want to have it, we can get rid of it. But I'd rather not have our decisions at this council table be driven by trying to address a lawsuit, because I don't think that's our job to do that. So you asked for perspectives on it, Mr. Chair. There they are.
Thank you very much. That was very deep and thoughtful, and I appreciate your comments. I just want to respond to your concerns with River Herring Shad. Obviously, I listened to the committee's discussion, and it sounds like, I'm not presupposing what's going to happen later today or tomorrow about what we do move forward for September, but if we do move forward with September just with specifications, there's definitely that want to move forward on River Herring Shad. So I don't see it as pushing it off again. I wholeheartedly believe we will continue working on that through the end of this year into next year. So thank you for that. Up next, I have Mr. Lucy and then Mr. Pierdnock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was basically the 4 points I was going to bring up. But in my own words, I think the court should just, this should play out. The courts, we're almost there. It's the last step. I don't think we need to cut that short. I do, though, support bringing it up as a concept in 2027 for a priority, so I'll lend my support to that. But I am also concerned about attaching any more items to the time area closure work that's going on. We need to keep that clean. We have a great data set. And to the last point, we do need some robust monitoring. We're not getting it from the IMF because it's really not been used. So we need something in replacement. And my personal feeling that is going to be a genetically based port side sampling program, which may or may not be in the purview of the council, maybe a commission action. So we're going to need some time for coordination on that, and potentially with the Mid-Atlantic Council and some of the other herring actions. So, support moving forward with it as a priority, but with those caveats. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lucey. Excuse me. Up next, Mr. Pierdnock, then Ms. Ware.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To maintain the goals and objectives of the IFM, if that was to disappear, I really look forward to the discussion this afternoon and the need for time area closures and shad and river herring, incidental catch caps, and the port side DNA. I'm with you there. I point that out, and that may be the mechanism to address not having the IFM. But also I throw out there, because it is 2026 and AI seems to be making major strides. I don't know if AI with cameras or something of that sort is a more affordable mechanism to do what the IFM is, but I'd just be say to look at that if that's a possibility. Thank you.
So are you in support of maybe considering this for 2027?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, I just wanted to be clear on that one. Ms. Ware.
Thanks. I'm okay saying we'll have it as a part of a discussion for 2027, but I'm certainly not ready to commit to that as a 2027 priority, so I just want that to be clear in whatever correspondence we're providing back. I think for me to feel more confident in the direction, knowing where we're going on the Shad and River herring is going to be important. So I don't know if this means this would be, a trailing action to that action. I agree with Melanie. I think the conversation's different if we're moving towards the closures as opposed to catch caps. That said, I heard industry very clearly on herring committee supporting catch caps over closures. So I think we need a little more certainty there as to where we're going, or at least I need that to be able to make this decision. And then I'll just note, as others have, I don't think whatever decision we make on Chatter River herring eliminates the uncertainty we're dealing with in the data. We're struggling on Chatter and River herring because we don't have a lot of data, and that's not going to change whatever method we choose. So our ability to evaluate the efficacy of those measures is going to be just as challenged moving forward. So I think that's something that we'll need to discuss. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Ware. Mr. Hrushevsky, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. excuse me. I think Megan hit a few of my points, but I kind of think it's pretty clear in the direction that we are going with regards to river herring and shad measures. It's kind of unfortunate that the information is not available to inform other options like biologically based catch caps. Closing off areas does not keep the industry working. I think I've heard Mitch give this report for the past 8 years with regards to where we are with the litigation. So with all that said, I will support sort of the discussion in 2027 under priority. So thank you.
Thank you for that, Mr. Hrushevsky. Terry, quickly.
Yeah, I support the 2027 discussion. But, I was here when the IFM went in before, and we were warned as a council that there wasn't any money to do this with, and we decided to push it forward anyway. So we need to bear that in mind, too. So,
thank you for that. I believe, Dr. O'Keefe, you may have what you need right at this point. I see nodding, so thank you very much. Sorry, Mr. Pappalardo.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. It doesn't matter what I think because I won't be here to vote on it. but
it always matters.
I encourage you to take it up in December for sure. Just a little background. I was actually here when we set up the management plan for the for Herring in Amendment 1 and obviously the IFM amendment as well. Terry's right. That's what we were told at the time. But I think a little background. There was a lot of concern back then. We had a fishery that was catching about I think it was the ABC, which we didn't have at the time because it didn't exist, but we had like a 160,000 metric ton opportunity for the fishery. And there was a lot of concern up and down the coast about what else was being caught. And I've listened to the comments today, and I think you have a good balance of people that think if we deal with river herring and shad, it takes care of that issue. They have other people that have clearly said there's more to it than that. The question over whether an industry should pay for monitoring is really the crux of the question. It's not just about herring, although herring is the only plan we're doing that in right now. There is a trigger in the groundfish plan as well. But I think people need to remember that if there isn't good monitoring of catch, then our system expects us to put a higher premium on uncertainty and build that into the formula. And so that's how we got to with herring. There was a lot of concern at the time, not just about river herring and shad, but obviously we have a haddock cap. There was a lot of concern at the time about striped bass intercepts and other fish as well. So we don't have 150 or 60 ton fishery right now, 1,000 ton fishery. We have a, whatever it is, 17 or 19,000 ton fishery. But I think you need to think about that issue in the context of a rebuilt herring fishery, which is the goal.
Thank you for that. So I think we have what we need. Dr. Hare.
Yeah, I just want to, I think there's a third fishery with an industry-funded observer component, that would be scallops. So just wanted to just clarify that for everyone. There are three industry-funded observer programs in the region. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. With that, I will close this one out. Sorry, Mr. Hansen. Mr.